Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a special, special guest. Her name is Becky Galli, and she is an author, writer, mother, and columnist. And I happen to have just read her two books. This was her original book, Rethinking Possible. And this one, you got to read this. It's unbelievable. You will not be able to put it down. The second book, I have an advanced reader copy, and it's called Morning Fuel. This will be out in October. And before I bring Becky to the studio, I'm going to just read her introduction. I don't know if I can read it without crying, but that's okay. Here it is. Some would say life has not been kind to me. At age 20, I lost my 17-year-old brother. Two of my four children had special needs. One of my two sons died at age 15. And at 38, 9 days after my divorce was finalized, I was paralyzed by transverse myelitis, a rare inflammation of the spinal cord that affects one in a million. More than once, it's been hard to find the strength to power through and live fully in this life I did not choose. And now, here we go. Becky Galli.
Hi, Hillary.
Hi, I told you I wouldn't get through without crying. But anyway.
It's all done. It's finished. There it is. You know, teed it up. We're good.
No. Anyone who's ever watched my show knows I cry. So, but anyway, thank you so much for being here. I know, you know, we've put it all out there now, so people will not be surprised. You know, and when you read Becky's book, Rethinking Possible, I mean, you'll just see the kind of childhood she had was just, I would say it was like charmed, right? She had the family that everybody wants. The mother and father got along. They were in love. They kept you, you know, they didn't allow you to go crazy, right? They had discipline, but also with so much love, right? And such good values, right? Your father was, what do you call him? Would you call him a minister or a?
Yes.
Yeah. Minister. So he had his own church and, you know, just they always represented good stuff, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, what do you want to say about your childhood, like when everything was still wonderful and rosy, right?
You know, it's interesting. I knew I had a good childhood, but I think after everything that I've been through, I think it gave me an incredible foundation to be able to handle what life has thrown at me. And I was, you know, at 20, watching your 17-year-old brother, you know, I didn't watch him die, but at that, I was in college and, you know, my dad called me and to let me know that it did not look good. And when he died, it was, you know, like an earthquake in our family. But we didn't fall apart. We did shatter physically. We went to different locations. I was in college. My sister was in high school. Dad had just gotten a new pastorate. And so he was in West Virginia. My mom was in North Carolina. So we shattered physically, but we stay connected. And I think watching my parents cope with the loss of their 17-year-old son is Forrest used to sign his name, your only begotten son, you know, I learned from that things I didn't even know I was learning at the time about coping. And I think it served me well. I'm so grateful for them and all they taught me. And the close-knit family was really by design. You know, we had family Saturdays and dinner times and a lot of structure that created close-knit family. And I think I've taken that with me, and it's been incredibly helpful.
Yeah. When I remember one of the comments you'd said, because you had, was it Saturday dinners or Saturday dinners? And then after your brother passed and your father had taken that football job, I guess he was the chaplain of the football team or something.
Yeah.
And that was on Saturdays. And you were like, what happened to our Saturday, right? That was different, right?
Yes. Yes. You know, he had this this philosophy. I think it took a while. I mean, there's so many stages of loss and grief, and the acute stage. And then I think, you know, you're the loss is like a, it really is an empty space. And, but what Dad later did, and he did with this Marshall football team, he called it reinvesting your love. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your love for your loved one, and that person isn't there anymore, but you have this love that needs to be invested somewhere or reinvested somewhere. And it's not that you lose it. You know, you're always love, you know, my brother or Dad will always be, you know, his son, but in order to express it, I think that's a wise thing that I've tried to carry forward too, reinvesting the love if you've lost.
And do you think, I mean, I know there's no accidents, but do you think he consciously found the football team? Do you think it found him? Like, how did that happen? You know?
I think sometimes we give it to mystery, give it to forces outside our control. You know, if we're spiritual people, give it to God, you know, that sometimes these things come into our lives and we just know that's the right thing to do. We feel compelled with that. We feel led. And he felt led, and it was a wonderful experience for him.
Yeah, because he didn't do that before that, right? He had no team. Wow, isn't that interesting? And then when your mother finally went out, when did your mother go to join him?
I think he was there about 6 months, maybe 8 months alone, because my sister was finishing up her high school. Okay. And so then they both went up there. So it was a interesting time in their marriage too, to live apart like that when you're so close as they were. That was a lot of learning for both of them, and appreciation of each other in different ways now.
Because he went to wherever he went, I can't remember, but he went after your brother passed, right? Before that,
yeah.
He was just there, right? So then they moved, right? Did they end up selling their house?
Yes, they sold the house and then they moved to West Virginia.
Okay.
From North Carolina.
Wow. And where was the family home? Like the family, the place that they went later on?
That was in North Carolina too. That was Lenore's, where his parents were from that area. And so there was a home place there where after my grandfather passed, we would go back to North Carolina there.
Yeah.
They resided in West Virginia until their death.
Wow. Okay. And then one of the things, I know it's at the end of the book, but I just keep thinking about it. It's instead of taking care of each other, he said, take care of yourself.
Yes. Yes. And that was probably one of the most surprising things, because when he had kidney cancer and it had come back with a vengeance, and we were in the hospital and we knew, you know, that he wasn't going to be recovering from this bout of it. And we all had hugged together and Dad had said a prayer, and then he told us, you know, take care of, and we all were expecting it to be each other. And he said, yourselves. And I think the truth is that oxygen on your on your face first before your child, when you're on that airplane, if there's turbulence, you can't really take care of each other if you're not healthy yourself. And I think it's a big principle because it's almost, you have to lean into that regularly. You know, when you feel spent, it's like, have you taken care of yourself? And then you can take care of others and it'd be more effective.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like, whoa. When I read that, like, you know, yeah. I mean, for me, it's like, it's selfish. You know what I mean? Like, I was always thought, well, it's selfish. You should be taking care of your kids or your mother or whatever. But it's like, no, that's not what he said. And it just makes you stop and think, oh, take care of myself first. Yeah. Because you can't be good for everyone else if you're not, like you said. So that was interesting. So after your brother died and you went back to college, I mean, I'm sure that was painful. But were there moments where you forgot and you were just like a regular college kid, you know, just a few moments here and there that you could just, I know how close you were. Did you end up having, what year was that he passed?
1978.
But what year were you?
I was a junior.
A junior.
Okay. So it was very interesting because I was a junior in college, and my sister was a junior in high school. And so we had very different experiences after we lost Forrest, because Rachel and Forrest were just, I think, 18 months apart. And so they were like this tag team, you know, going through high school together, had the same friends. And so Rachel had the comfort, but also the pressing memory of her brother not being there. And at college, people had met Forrest, but they didn't know our family, you know, our whole unit wasn't there. It was just, you know, Forrest is cool and came to visit you. And
right.
So in one sense, Rachel had a lot of support and a lot of knowledge, but in the other sense, she got no relief from that.
Right.
There was no time where she could just be Rachel missing her brother. It's everybody was in grief with her. And in my situation, I could disconnect from that a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Which on the one hand made it easier because some people didn't, you know, they didn't even know I had a brother or lost a brother. They just, I was, you know, just Becky. My close friends knew, and I could cry with them and they would understand it. Some of them had met my mom and dad and come to my home a couple of times. My roommates and suite mates knew that. And it's interesting, after I wrote the book and they read it, they were like, was that there for you? You know, was I there for, and I said, yes, you were. Sometimes it was just like, let's go shopping or let's, you know, go to a movie. And those kind of things was structure. And I think that's so important when you're going through this kind of loss, is to have structure and to not isolate and have people around you that can keep you moving through the grief instead of getting stuck in it.
That's great. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So Rachel, so she went off to college. So at least she had a change of scenery a little bit, right? And then you graduated. And that was when you were starting to see Joe, right? Sort of.
Kind of. Yeah.
Well, who was the guy that you were seeing that was his roommate?
Yes. Yeah.
Which one was that?
Who was that? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
His name was Carter.
Carter. Yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure if it was the guy that ended up writing to you in the end. So that's why I was asking the one that became your pen pal. Oh, I know what I was going to ask. How it seemed like, you had so much detail in all of, like, about your childhood and everything. How did you remember all that? Or was it just, you know, I mean, throughout the thing, it was like, it was happening now. Like, that's how there was so much detail and so much expression. And I felt like I could feel you, you know, like I could feel your emotions with you. Do you know what I mean? It was so well written. And so, yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I was in your shoes. I was living your life. Like, that's how well written it was, that I felt like I had gone through it with you, you know?
Well, thank you. Thank you. I learned early on, probably beginning with Forrest, the power of journaling. And so if I got stuck, a lot of times I'd have these ruminating thoughts that were just same thoughts keep going. And so I learned to kind of lasso them in and put them on the page. And if I was having them again, at least I could say, well, I've already thought through that, you know, are we doing that again? So I didn't keep these journals. And so I kept them when Forrest died, and I kept them through my special needs children. And then with my paralysis, recounting all this to my friend you mentioned before, my pen pal friend, his name was Scott. He was somebody I hadn't seen in many years. And then my father had written a column about my strange infection, this transverse myelitis. And so I got this email from him, 1997. This is back when the email was just becoming prevalent. He said, you know, is that you? And I'm like, yeah, it's me. And so I hadn't seen him in a very long time, but he had been a member of one of my dad's churches, and I was in my youth group. So we had those kind of roots. And so I pretty much took him from the last time we saw each other through my life in this interaction back and forth. And that's when I really started, you know, thinking, geez, maybe I could pull this together at some point to tell the whole story.
Yeah. And he didn't mind, right? Because he was married, right?
He's married. Just good buddies, you know, still are.
So, and did he write stuff back to you? Because we never saw his side. Like, was he writing about his life too?
Somewhat, but he was just so curious. He was so curious about how it all fit together. And I did. The book had different versions. And at one version, there was more of a conversation back and forth. But it got to the point where it's like, let's just tell your story through this vehicle at this point.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So, all right. So let's take you through. So you graduate college, you're friends with Joe, and then, and the other one, Carter, he was long gone, right? He was bad. He was bad.
Yeah, we're still friends. He wasn't bad. He was just not for me.
I thought he was like cheating on you and stuff, or no?
Well,
go ahead.
We just didn't, we weren't in a committed relationship. So when you aren't in a committed relationship, then you're free to move on. And we both did.
Okay. All right. I won't say anything bad. Okay. Whatever. All right. Moving on. So then you and Joe get serious and you move together to you were with IBM and he was always with Black & Decker, right?
Right.
Okay. And then you got married, right?
Yeah, we had apartments next to each other in Charlotte, and then we started dating, and then we got married and moved to Atlanta.
Okay.
And that's
okay.
Where we had our first home.
Wow. Okay. And then you had Brittany you worked a few years. I know you were like a workaholic, working, and very successful, right?
Yes. Well, workaholic. And yes, we both were. We were kind of good for each other that way. We reined each other in when we were overdoing it, but yes.
Okay. And then how many years later did you have Brittany?
It was so interesting. We were married, I think it was 8 years, right? But my goals were to get a 10-year career in and to have my first child by the time I was 30. And for Joe to get his MBA. So we had all, you know, life was going as planned.
Yeah.
And so we did. Brittany was born when I was 29, and he had finished his MBA, and we had moved to Baltimore by that time. He had transferred, and I was able to transfer my career as well. And so we have a beautiful baby girl.
Wow. And then you managed that with the job, right? How did you do that again?
We had a nanny, a girl that would come in the home and help us with Brittany so I could go to work. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So that everything was full charging, right? And then when did things start changing? Did you have the miscarriage after Brittany?
I had one miscarriage after Brittany and then another miscarriage after Matthew. Okay.
Yeah, those are hard. I had two of those too, but it was early on. So, I mean, it's still hard, but I didn't realize how many people had them until after I had them. You know, it's not something that people talk about, right?
Right. And it's a huge loss that we really experience in a different way than, the most caring husband in the world doesn't really understand the physical changes your body starts making in preparation for something that doesn't come.
Right. So, okay. So you already had Matthew. So how far apart were Brittany and Matthew? How many years?
Three years.
Okay. And was Matthew still okay then when you had the miscarriage or?
No. His seizures developed when he was 3 months old.
Okay.
And so, we were going through that and trying to figure out if it was an episode or a long-term situation. It wound up being long, chronic. So we were dealing with that, but we had been told that his situation, because there was something beyond the seizures, there was a degenerative part of this that made it so that he couldn't hit his milestones. So we had genetic testing done, and they had told us that it was, as I say in the book, a fluke, that it wasn't anything that genetically that anything that happened, it was rare, and they encouraged us to go ahead and, have additional children if that's what we wanted to do, which we did. We'd always wanted to have 4 kids. And so had another miscarriage, and then I was pregnant with Madison, and she too had, Matthew was healthy at birth, and Madison was healthy at birth. And then later on, I was so sensitized to milestones because Matthew was failing at those, that I noticed that when Madison's speech wasn't coming in like it should, we had her diagnosed and she had autism. So we were dealing with that. But by the time we got that diagnosis, I was already pregnant with my 4th, Peter. And so it got a little crazy, but I had good help. Joe was very successful, and so I was able to hire the help I needed, and family helped as they could. I was very, very lucky for all that that support. I needed it.
And had you stopped working by then?
I did after Matthew. There was IBM offered a bridge to early retirement, and so I took it. The timing was right. And so, yes, I was home.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, how, like you say, two special needs, how did you deal with that? I mean, were you just so busy that you just did what you had to do? Did you ever get to process it, or why me, or how this, or, look to see, I think I would have been like, whose fault is this, or whatever. Like, how did you get through that? And I'm sure there's a lot of people with special needs kids out there,
Yes. It's there's a lot of anger and a lot of trying to figure out where to put that. And But at the same time, these kids are there and they need you and you need to do things. And it's this odd thing that happens where you're so angry and feel incredibly sad and terrible injustice. And then they cry and they need you, or they need a doctor's appointment, or they need additional medication. So it's almost like their neediness helps you move through that pain.
Mm.
In a really unexpected way. But just looking back, I thought, how in the world did I do that? But I had good help, and I had, I was in therapy. I credit Dr. Luco often in Rethinking Possible and also in Morning Fuel, just for the steadfast guidance. You get good help, mentally, physically. I was trying to work out and at least be outside with the kids, and then spiritual support as well, relying on people. I was angry at God for quite a while. We weren't on speaking terms, but other people prayed for me when I couldn't pray for myself, when I was too angry to pray. I was like, what the heck? Can you pick on another family for a change? Good grief. I think the same thing about, don't isolate and get support and keep structure. And I have this thing, I was like, after a while, it's like I discovered, you can't go through these things alone. So who is in your boat? Who is going to help you navigate this storm? And that varies from calamity to calamity, whether it be my own medical condition or my children's medical condition, and the people that can help and help you see straight and be a resource for you. And so it's this ongoing, who can help me? Who can be in this boat with me as I get through this? And to not give up. If somebody turns out to be a dud, you kind of uninvite them, or just don't invite them to the next boat. But that's very important in my experience, to have good, capable people in there with you as you try to figure it out.
So I think at least there's a lot of people, or maybe just me, who I don't want to ask for help. I think I should be strong. I think I should be able to handle this, or I don't want to let people know that I'm having a hard time, or something. I mean, how was it hard for you to ask for help, or did you just not have a choice, or was that just part of your upbringing? I think, and when you say like, don't isolate, I think there's shame, in some circles for feeling bad or for thinking that you can't handle it or for being angry or something, my mother, I love her. She's 94, but her thing is always like, be perky and peppy. So it's like, you weren't supposed to be upset. And, she never asked for help. She's always, she just like amazing, when you say who's in your boat, like, was that hard for you, or was that natural from your upbringing to ask for help and to get ask people to help you and to rely on them?
I think the way Dad would always talk about it would be, examine your resources. And in that sense, it isn't necessarily asking for help, but it's knowing where you could go for help. Because I think there's a kind of a qualification process of who you decide to ask for help. This thing we call, appropriate self-disclosure, right? Like, how much do I want to tell this person about it? Can I trust them with everything I need to unload, or a part of what I need to unload? Because, people are human, and you want to make sure that what you share is kept confidential, and so there's kind of a qualification process. But I think examining your resources, like who can help me if I choose to reach out for them, is worthwhile no matter what. Even if you never pick up the phone, you've got a list. Mm-hmm. So it's a thoughtful process. It's not, but I do think that I tend to be very independent as much as I can. But when you're paralyzed, guess what? You can't do everything that you want to do. And so through that and these other kind of losses, you realize that when you ask for help, it's actually a strength. And I think the strength is being discerning as to which of these resources I can ask for help. And knowing which one, you know, that can really be helpful is a strength. It really is an evaluation strength of yours to say, yeah, I've got these four, but this one's going to be the best here. And it kind of puts your brain into this analytical gear instead of, woe is me, I need rescuing. You know, I don't need rescuing, I need help to get through it. Not to feel sorry for me, but to offer suggestions. Now, there's sometimes I just need to cry. You know, my sister knows that. It's like I just like, you know, this is terrible. And, you know, she can take it. And I trust her.
Wow. All right. We've got more to come after our commercial break. Thank you so much, Becky, for your courage and your inspiration. So we will be back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teacher's plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social-emotional learning to your children at school, your teams, your businesses, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a consultation. They are incredible, and it just brings connection, that emotional support that we've been talking about, to children who, you know, might not have that or might not think it's okay. So I recommend KikoriApp.com very highly. And then, as always, my books, I like to promote them here. My memoir, it's a juicy summer read, or any kind of read, The Second Piece of French Toast. You're not allowed to judge me, but it's very honest, I have to tell you that. And then we have Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. If you find yourself on a side of life, again, Becky doesn't seem to get as stuck there as I did, or I do, but I needed tools and techniques, so I discovered them and wrote a book about them, from getting what I call from the left side of life, where things don't look so great, back to the right side, where there's possibility, happiness, and joy. And that's Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. And then the one that my commercial is about is Real Talk. After I wrote my first books, one of the people who read it said, why didn't you speak up? And I was like, oh, I didn't even know I wasn't. So I had to learn the hard way how to speak up. And this book kind of gives you a shortcut. If you're a people pleasing, pleasant phony like me, always saying you're fine. Well, this teaches you how to speak up. And again, what we talked about with Becky. So it's called Real Talk. You can go to realtalkwithhillary.com or email me at Hillary at gettingrealwithhillary.com. Hillary's with one L. Thank you so much. And now we're going to bring Becky back for the rest of the story. So when did things start going in your marriage? Why don't you talk about that?
Well, I think any time that a family has a special needs child or children, it becomes hard to be together in a marriage and problem solve through it. And we tried to resolve the gaps, and we just couldn't do it. And had counseling for 3 years, tried various things, but we both agreed that it would be better to be apart than together. And his support for me continued, though, and his care for me. And he was, you know, there for the children as well. So that was a very tough time, but we made it through, you know. And when we divorced, I wasn't paralyzed. It was only after the divorce that the paralysis came, and Joe was there for me and our family in ways I can still can't believe how supportive he was and how encouraging he was. And even now we're still friends, and our family is close knit again by design and with a lot of effort. Just as my folks showed me how to do that in that family, we've tried to continue that in this family. So it was tough.
No. You can't know this, but if you had known, nine days after you signed the papers, you'd be paralyzed. Would you have not? Because it seemed like Joe went back to his old caring self after that.
Yeah. I saw the part of him that I saw when I married him come back into play after the paralysis, but. You know, we'd made decisions, and it was time to move through it. And he was willing to help me get through it.
So you never looked back?
Oh, you always look back. Right? You always look back. What is it? You look back, but you don't stare.
Okay, good.
So I don't stare. I was like, yeah, that could have been different, but it didn't. So what are you doing next? You know, it's always about possibility. And I try to minimize regrets, look for possibilities, you know, look back. And if I can learn from it, absolutely. I might stare at a smidge, but I'm not going to, you can't rewrite history. You can just rewrite your attitude about it. And that's about it.
That's great. No regrets. So when you got paralyzed, I had hope.
That it wasn't permanent.
And then one day. you said. Okay.
You said, okay. Right. Well, transverse spondylitis is one of those no cause, no cure situations, as is autism, as is epilepsy. And so it's like, here we go again. But I had hope, realistically, because a third of those paralyzed with transverse myelitis recover fully. Another third recover partially. And the last third don't recover at all. So it's like, surely it's my turn to get a break, right? And so you go through with hope that, yep, one of these days I'm going to wake up and I'm going to wiggle that toe. You know, that toe was the last thing that wiggled before I couldn't wiggle anything else. And so every morning I'd get up and try to wiggle that toe. And it wouldn't wiggle. So in the meantime, though, and this is one of the things I've written about both places, actually, I had a therapist that said, you know, when I was trying to figure out with Matthew, was he going to grow out of these seizures or not grow out of these seizures? Was it going to become degenerative or not? She recommended this approach called parallel paths. When you're in uncertainty, you're not sure it could go either way. She said, pursue both at the same time. You know, the hope that I'm going to recover fully, but the reality that I may not recover at all. And so journeying on both of those paths at the same time enabled me to do things on both sides. I could, on the hope path, keep my body ready to walk, you know, practice standing, do exercises, take all these supplements. You know, on the reality side, you know, I did put some ramps in my house. I considered putting an elevator in my house so that I could, you know, my kids' bedroom were upstairs and I was downstairs. There's no way for me to get upstairs. So this dueling journey allowed me to keep moving forward and being prepared for either one and feel like I was accomplishing things. For me, that's always something. I like to be accomplishing something, you know. And so that technique, that parallel paths, that technique of paralyzed paths, one of them was the parallel paths allows you to keep in motion, which I think is really important as you're moving through any kind of uncertainty to have something to move forward with.
And then the day when you accepted it.
Yes. You know, the thing about acceptance is it really brings a lot of freedom. Because there's angst in doing two things at once. There's, you know, and there's this hyper monitoring. Am I making progress more on this one than that one? And so the one day it's like, I'm just going to stop trying to wiggle that toe. And I'm going to put all my energy into living the fullest life I can as a paraplegic. And it was something incredibly freeing. So all of that energy that I'd spent looking at recovery and hoping, and I could now dedicate fully to how can I be a parent as a paraplegic? You know, what can I do? I'd been going to therapy every single night for weeks and weeks, and it was during the dinner hour. And I missed the dinner hour with my kids. And my dinner hour, as you know, from Rethinking Possible book, was very important to me. And I like reinstituted that. And that was back in the days when you could have the CD clubs. And so I bought all these CDs that could play those at dinner. So my kids would have classical music and they'd have rock and roll and they'd have my favorite, which is funk. And we, you know, have dance parties after dinner, and I'd light candles with every dinner so that we would recreate family. And I said, I'm leaning into this. I got to be in this wheelchair. We're going to do things that still are going to make family. But acceptance does change everything once you finally accept what it is that you've come to the conclusion you need to. The problem is pushing acceptance. Like, do I really have to accept that? Or is there something else I can accept that's not that? That's always the challenge.
I think with acceptance comes peace.
Peace. Yes. Yep.
Because you're not fighting it.
And the fight takes a lot of energy. You know, my mom used to say you have 24 buckets of energy a day. How are you going to use them? And we get to decide that every morning we get up, which is part of the reason I wrote Morning Fuel, because my morning times are my times for restoration, for encouragement, for inspiration. And that's when you look as you're writing, you know, you want a lens to look at the book, and it's like, what do I want these things to bring to people's mornings? And it's like, I want either it to inspire, encourage, or make you think, because those are the three things that I look for in my mornings to be inspired, encouraged, or make me think. And it just kind of depends on how I wake up that day, which of those three I need. And sometimes I need all of them. But getting restored and those buckets of energy fired up for the next 24 hours. And then you have a lot more choices when you have full energy.
Hmm. Did your kids look at you differently, or you were still?
You were still. You know, like Peter was three. They were 3, 4, 6, and 9. And, you know, I don't know. Brittany was 9. And it'd be really interesting now, you know, they're in their 30s. So I don't know what they remember. And what I've come to realize is that what you don't remember still can affect you. Mm. You know, and so I don't know what effect my paralysis had on them. I know that there were many times I would cry just because I couldn't be the kind of mom I wanted to be. You know, I couldn't be down on the ball fields. I watched Peter's soccer games with binoculars from a parking lot if the field was too muddy, you know, and I couldn't do a lot of the things I would want to do with them. But it was really, you know, I figured out how to do the most important things. But it wasn't what I would have wanted. You know, I had to be a different kind of mom. So I don't know what they would say. It'd be interesting what book they would write.
Yeah. Especially Brittany, I think.
Yeah. She's a tough cookie. She is.
Yeah.
And they've seen a lot, you know, and my hope would be, just as I watched my parents go through the grief of losing their son and what I learned from them about resilience and about moving through grief, that maybe something their experience could be helpful to them as they go through life. Because very few of us make it through unscathed. Without some kind of loss that redirects us in a direction we didn't want to go.
Yeah.
Well, Becky,
I'm going to let you talk about your community and what you want to join, because I have this echo that's making me crazy.
Do you mind?
No, not at all.
Go ahead.
So, yes, I would love to have your audience become part of my audience and join my subscriber family. I do a little email called Thoughtful Thursdays, where on Thursdays, not every Thursdays, but a lot of Thursdays, it used to be every week, but now I've kind of giving myself a little grace and with the books coming out. Yes, and that's at BeckyGalli.com, BeckyGalli.com. And there's a way you can sign up to be, join my subscriber family. I would love to have you. Of course, I'd love for you to buy my book and the one that's coming out in October. And there's a way to do that on my website as well. I've been writing columns for, 25 years now. And a lot of them are on my website. If you just want to, there's a search bar at the top. You can put in anything you want and see what pops up. It might be helpful to you. I'd love that.
All right, awesome. Okay. I have an echo, everyone. That's why I'm driving crazy. So, Becky, what would you hope to see the world in your country, your inspiration.
Can you say that again? You were kind of breaking up.
What's your vision for the world?
Oh, dear. That's a loaded question. My vision for the world? You know, there's a piece I wrote in, actually it's in both books. I loved it so much. It was to Brittany and Brian on their wedding day. And it was about how to love. And my message to them was to let your love be larger. Let your love be larger than the situation, than who's right or wrong. And I just wish we could figure out ways to love one another in a non-judgmental way that could be inclusive, supportive, and work for the common good of humanity. You know, and I think love is really the key to that, to figure out what that means in a practical way. But that's what my, for everybody to let their love be larger.
That's beautiful. And what's one lesson that you have learned?
I think the most important thing when you're facing something unexpected is to be honest with yourself, what you're feeling, what the circumstance is, what your resources are, and to not deny reality, even though it's something you don't want to accept. And maybe you don't have to at the moment, but even acknowledge, I don't know what this is. I don't know what this means, to even say, I don't know out loud, and just be very honest about life and about your feelings, because that matters and how you get through it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Read it.
Yes. Thank you.
Pre-order this. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.